Yes.
So with regards to the next week's assignment.
Or next month's assignment?
The next month. Are we also handing in a hard copy as well?
I will be sending you an email about that. Okay, if I get Moodle up and running soon enough, then that's where you hand it in. If I don't, then it'll be a hard copy only. Okay? So I'll let you know as soon as I can. But for now, let's plan on the hard copy. And with any luck, maybe we'll do both. You had a question. No. Pick the pieces that you think are the most interesting and relevant, and just comment on that. Okay? Who has the sign-up sheet for the readings? Are they all done now?
It appears as though it's all completed.
There's a few
spaces left.
Yeah. So do the required readings first, and only go to suggested if all the required are filled up. So that was a real treat to hear Peter Russell. And I came away with two thoughts about his presentation. One is just the importance of trying to understand each other as Canadians. I was very lucky at the end of my fourth year as an undergrad, I won an award from the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. It's called the Canadian Travel Award. And they took the winners, two from each province, across the whole country in 2 weeks. And we went to every provincial capital, we met every provincial premier and lieutenant governor and the business leaders in every capital. And it was absolutely fascinating because it taught me just how diverse this country is and how much every part of the country wants to be recognized. And I think that's what constitutional politics has been all about. Certainly when I was in Alberta in 1982, the reason why Alberta was so difficult in those negotiations and came up with a different amending formula, the need to be recognized. And certainly the impression that Albertans got from the rest of the country is that they thought, it's just a very unimportant part of the country. We don't need to really recognize the differences or contributions of Albertans. But people in every part of the country feel the same. Certainly the Aboriginals want to be recognized for who they are. And I'm really glad that Peter Russell emphasized the importance of Aboriginal rights. So what I'd like to do now is to skip ahead a little bit in my PowerPoints to get to just thinking about the development of human rights prior to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Prior to 1960, when we had a Canadian Bill of Rights, sometimes the judges tried to protect human rights through the division of powers. Now, Dicey, I mentioned Dicey earlier on, he wrote that countries based on the British system don't really need a written Bill of Rights, because as long as judges understand the rule of law, they will protect human rights, because the rule of law applies equally to everyone. So laws that are discriminatory for no reason, judges have a right to strike them down because the rule of law is one of the most fundamental constitutional principles of the British legal system. So he argued that a constitutional Bill of Rights is dangerous because it's so hard to change, so hard to keep up to date, so hard to amend. And the reason why Canada didn't have a constitutional Bill of Rights until 1982 was mainly because Dicey had such a strong influence on the thinking of the Canadian legal community. It's dangerous to have an entrenched Bill of Rights. In the United States, what happened? They entrenched the equality principle. The Supreme Court said that means separate but equal. So they actually entrenched this discrimination for 100 years. And Dicey was aware of that and very critical of the American Supreme Court for entrenching discrimination when the American Bill of Rights was designed to do just the opposite. So prior to in 1960, we got a Canadian Bill of Rights. Prior to that time, there were human rights abuses that the courts tried to correct. and through the division of powers. Now, remember, I mentioned earlier the social credit legislation that tried to regulate banking. Part of the suite of legislation brought in by the social credit government was that any newspapers that were critical of social credit theory could be censored. So that led to the Alberta Press case of 1938, and that was one of the readings for today. So the impugned legislation, that's the legislation that is brought into question. The federal government sent a reference question to the Supreme Court of Canada. Is the social credit legislation trying to regulate banks and to censor newspapers, is it constitutional? And the judges, the majority of judges, said, no, it's not. Obviously it's not, because clearly Section 91 gives the regulation of banking to the federal government. The Alberta Press Bill is really designed to support the banking legislation, and so it's unconstitutional as well. But a minority of judges, including Chief Justice Duff, developed what was later known as the Duff Doctrine. Because Canada is similar in principle to the, has a constitutional similar in principle to that of the United Kingdom. Remember the preamble to the Constitution Act 1867, we have a constitutional similar in principle. The courts can strike down legislation that violates the human rights principles that had developed in the United Kingdom up till 1867. Canada is a democracy. Why is it a democracy? Because the Constitution Act 1867 says that the House of Commons is representative of the whole country. It's more or less proportional representation from all the parts of Canada to the House of Commons. So therefore, we are a representative democracy. Free public discussion is the breath of life for parliamentary institutions. Free public discussion is the breath of life for parliamentary institutions. So there's an example of a judge who said, look, in addition to banking's a federal responsibility, it's more fundamental than that. If we take Dicey seriously, there are human rights that are protected by the rule of law. Let's be a little bit more creative in interpreting the Constitution of Canada to protect human rights. So there are a number of cases, starting with the Alberta Press case, and going through the cases that came out of the Duplessis period in Quebec, where the Duplessis government, which was a very authoritarian government, had all kinds of laws to restrict freedom of expression, freedom of speech. They were particularly hard on the Jehovah's Witnesses in Quebec. And through the division of powers, Supreme Court judges were able to strike down discriminatory Quebec legislation. But Canadians began to feel that, well, maybe we need more than just the judges applying Dicean principles and the division of powers to protect human rights, because there is a lot of abuse of human rights in the country. And one of those people was John Diefenbaker. He was the Prime Minister of Canada in the late 50s and early 60s. He was a Saskatchewan lawyer, and he saw a number of instances where he thought there had been human rights abuses in Saskatchewan, and he thought that we need more than just relying on the judges to apply the rule of law to protect human rights. He wanted a constitutional bill of rights for the whole country. But he couldn't get the provinces to agree because they were steeped in Dicean theory. So he said, okay, we'll go ahead federally. We'll have a federal bill of rights that applies only to the federal jurisdiction. So that was the Canadian Bill of Rights that came in 1960. It's important to know about because the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms really expands on the rights and freedoms that were covered in the Canadian Bill of Rights in 1960. And the content of it is kind of summarized in this slide. I'll let you look at it later. The Canadian Bill of Rights, for the most part, turned out to be a big disappointment. to Canadians that believed in human rights. For example, we had a piece of federal legislation called the Lord's Day Act. It said that, now this dated from British legislation, going back centuries, businesses had to close on Sunday in order to respect Christian principles. So it was really putting the ideals of one particular religion into practice so that everyone had to respect them. The Lord's Day Act was challenged in 19... It's a federal piece of legislation, challenged in 1963. But the Supreme Court of Canada said the preamble to the Bill of Rights says that human rights have existed and shall continue to exist. In other words, Diefenbaker wanted to recognize that this wasn't something new. He was simply writing down human rights that had existed. Well, the Lord's Day Act had been around for a long time, so it must not violate human rights. So the Lord's Day Act was upheld as not violating freedom of religion. Then we had the Drybones decision in 1970, which is practically the only decision where human rights were actually upheld under the Bill of Rights. Now, Drybones was a trapper, an Indian trapper in the Northwest Territories. There was a federal regulation that status Indians were not allowed to get drunk in a public place. Drybones had a bit too much to drink in a hotel in Yellowknife. And, of course, there are no... status Indians cannot get drunk off a reserve. There are no reserves in the Northwest Territories, or at least there weren't at that time. So, he was arrested and charged with violating the Indian Act by being drunk off a reserve. Paid his $10 fine, went back to the traffic, to the trap line. A young lawyer from Toronto, who was looking for business in Yellowknife, saw that Drybones had been convicted of violating the Indian Act. And the lawyer said, well, to me, that's a violation of the Canadian Bill of Rights. He went out and he found Drybones on the trap line and said, would you allow me to appeal on your behalf? And Drybones, there had to be a translator, he didn't speak English. And Drybones said, yes, go ahead. And the lawyer said, I'm doing this as my centennial project, no charge to you. So Drybones agreed. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada in 1970. The Supreme Court of Canada said, obviously, the Indian Act applies only to Indians. It's racial discrimination. So they struck down the part of the Indian Act that said it was illegal for an Indian to be intoxicated off a reserve. So this was good, and people began to think, gee, maybe the Canadian Bill of Rights is going to mean something. Then we get to Lavelle and Bedard. That's one of the other cases that I asked you to look at for today. Now, Mrs. Lavelle, I've met her. Her son Nimke, whom she went to court for, used to be the residence life coordinator for the McLaughlin College residence called Tatum Hall, just a few hundred yards from here. And I know Nimke. But anyway, as Peter Russell mentioned, the Indian Act in those days said that Indian men could marry non-status women, but the non-status women then got status, and their children and grandchildren and so on were status immigrants. But Indian women could not marry non-Indians and retain the status. They immediately lost their status. Their children lost any entitlement to status. status means things like the right to live on a reserve, the right to have the benefits of schooling and so on. Sometimes there are scholarships available through the reserves to Indian people and so on. So Mrs. Lavelle was horrified that by marrying a non-Indian, a Welshman, that she lost her status, and her son, Nimke, lost his status, and grandchildren, and so on in the future. So, she got in touch with some lawyers in Toronto who agreed to represent her to go to court to challenge that part of the Indian. Well, given the dry bones decision, that was certainly discrimination. So, wasn't part of the Indian Act that discriminated against Indian women, wouldn't that be discrimination too? So, now this created a huge debate. I used to teach at the University of Lethbridge. It's right next to the Blood Reserve, the biggest reserve area-wise in Canada. A number of my students were Native students. And there was a real division between the young men and the young women, because the young men said, we can't allow any change in the Indian Act here, because think of all the thousands of Indian women who married non-Indians that are going to overrun the reserves in the future if they're given status. The Indian women said, no, that's not fair. Men and women are equal whether they're Indians or not. It was quite amazing to see this debate. Anyway, by a 5-4 majority, the Supreme Court of Canada said, this part of the Indian Act is not a violation of the Canadian Bill of Rights. There's no discrimination here. They gave a number of reasons. For example, there's nothing forcing Indian women to marry non-Indians. That's a choice that they make. If they want to give up their status, that's fine. There was a more important reason. And that had to do with matter and form requirements. Some people had argued that the Canadian Bill of Rights was a matter and form requirement. In other words, it applied to past legislation, but there was a presumption that for future legislation, Canadian legislatures would assume that the Canadian Bill of Rights applied unless the Canadian Parliament issued a declaration that the Canadian Bill of Rights did not apply. So there's, in some of my slides here, I tried to show how during the Bill of Rights cases, some of the judges switched sides. First they thought, well, let's give the Canadian Bill of Rights the broadest possible interpretation. Others said, no, it's dangerous. The Bill of Rights needs to be a constitutional document, not just an ordinary piece of legislation. And they kept changing their minds and really contradicting themselves from year to year. But in the Lavelle and Bedard case, the majority finally decided, let's not interpret the Canadian Bill of Rights broadly. Let's not consider it a matter and form change to how legislation is passed. Let's interpret it narrowly. There will have to be a constitutional Bill of Rights if we're going to actually recognize the rights and freedoms in the Canadian Bill of Rights. So that is really set the stage for the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So Trudeau took up where Diefenbaker left off. Trudeau was a great critic of the Duplessis government in Quebec. Trudeau wanted to teach law at the university level in Quebec, but because he had been involved in Cité Libre and the reformist movements in Quebec, he was on the blacklist for Duplessis. Duplessis went to the universities and said, here are the people on my blacklist. You hire any of them, your funding will be cut. So, he couldn't get a job. So, he thought, well, I'll become Prime Minister in Canada. We'll have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This will not happen in the future. So, interesting times. Any questions before I go back to some of the boring stuff? Yes?
I'm sure this is it. So the Bill of Rights is not in the Constitution, but the Charter of Rights is in the Constitution.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The Bill of Rights is an ordinary piece of parliamentary legislation. And the interesting thing is that although the judges eventually decided not to give much weight to the Canadian Bill of Rights, Once the Charter of Rights and Freedoms came into place, the judges changed their minds, and they said, well, now it's okay to recognize the Canadian Bill of Rights because the people of Canada have decided that the judges should be empowered to enforce human rights. So they began to call the Canadian Bill of Rights a quasi-constitutional document. And they recognized some of the Human Rights Acts as called quasi-constitutional documents. And so there's a huge boost in judicial interpretation of human rights legislation thanks to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And there are parts of the Canadian Bill of Rights that are more broadly worded than the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Two in particular. The Bill of Rights recognizes property rights. Now this is only with regard to the federal jurisdiction. Property rights is not discussed in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And the Canadian Bill of Rights respects the right to a fair hearing. With regard to almost any proceeding, almost any legal proceeding. Whereas the Charter of Rights restricts a fair hearing to criminal cases. So the Canadian Bill of Rights, we'll be talking in November about one of the Charter of Rights cases, the Singh decision, with regard to refugee rights. One of the few cases where you had six judges deciding, three decided based on the Canadian Bill of Rights to support a fair hearing for refugees, and three decided on the Canadian Charter of Rights. But the judges that said they decided on the Charter of Rights said they agreed with the broader interpretation of the Canadian Bill of Rights. So it was a resurrection of the Canadian Bill of Rights and a reinterpretation of it. Any other questions? So we have just a few more minutes. I'll say that in the October class, we're going to go over seven division of powers cases decided by the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council or the Supreme Court of Canada. And also a really important human rights case called Roncarelli versus Duplessis. Roncarelli versus Duplessis isn't in the Russell casebook, but it is on the class webpage. It's not very long. It's one of the Jehovah's Witnesses cases from Quebec. And in the November class, we'll be focusing on 12 important Charter of Rights cases decided by the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, it's not easy reading judicial decisions. In preparing for the October, well, you read a couple of cases for this class. In preparing for the October class, you'll get better at it. I'm giving you a little bit of information about what to look for in understanding judicial decisions, giving you some of the terms and concepts and so on. But what you need to do when you're reading the case is, what is the holding? What is the ratio? What is actually decided by this case? And what are words in passing, or which are dicta? What are simply ways in which the judges have kind of described how they got to their final conclusion, but are not necessarily things that are going to be followed by courts in the future? So try to ask yourself that when you go through the cases for October. Now I'm giving you even more cases for November, because you'll be so good at reading cases by then. You'll just find you get better and better. And the reason I'm having you read cases is because in your work in the public sector, there will be important court decisions that come along that affect the work that you do. It's important for you to be able to go online, find the judicial decisions, read them, and understand them. You'll be so much further ahead in your offices and employment if you can do that. Very often, the summaries of those cases in the newspapers are really inaccurate. And sometimes the lawyers tell you about what those cases mean is, well, they've looked at it too quickly. It's inaccurate. So the nice thing about the Russell Case book is you've got just parts of the cases that are really important for you to read. And then in the future, you can go online, read the entire 120-page decision of the Supreme Court of Canada, and you can skim through it really quickly because you know what to look for. You know the important things to look for. When you look at outside of the Russell Case book, you look at the actual decisions of the Supreme Court of Canada, there's about a 10-page part at the very beginning called the headnotes. And the headnotes are, it consists of a summary of what the judges said, written either by one of the lawyers who works for the Supreme Court or one of the law clerks for the judges. So it kind of summarizes what they said. And that's, most of the time, that's all you need to read. The headnotes summarize everything. But if you want to find out what the judges really said, and you're really interested in it, then you can go and use a search feature in your computer to find the parts that where the judges elaborate on what the headnotes summary. I've got 4 minutes. I need to use every minute. So this is something I just need to mention to you. We've talked about stare decisis. The judges will often mention the concept of natural justice. And the concept of natural justice is referred to in Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Natural justice is a common law principle developed by judges over the centuries in England. It basically says, with regard to legal matters, no one can be a judge in his or her cause. They always put it in Latin, so you can impress your friends with this phrase. Nemo iudex in sua causa. You cannot be a judge in your own case. Okay, so that means judges have to be impartial. They cannot have a conflict of interest where they could be seen to be partial to one side or the other. So it recognizes the principle of judicial impartiality. It goes further than that. Members of administrative tribunals have to be impartial. Nemo iudex in sua causa. Audi alteram partem. That means hear both sides. So those are the two basic principles of natural justice. And they're so important in every case that you will be reading. Hear both sides. That means the judge has to be impartial. Both sides have to be able to fully present their case. If a judge was to say to one party or the other, you're going on a little bit too long. It's almost closing time. I'm going to make a decision in a few minutes, even if you haven't finished your presentation. Good grounds for appeal. Violation of natural justice. Functions of administrative agencies. Oh. Let's just leave that for now. That's really an administrative law concept. Okay. Judges, I mentioned that Section 96 judges have said that because they are superior court judges and no government can reduce the jurisdiction of superior court judges, they have the right to hear administrative law appeals. And legislatures cannot take away that right. So, in particular, the judges have said that they have a right to review any administrative decision. With regard to jurisdiction, what if a provincial administrative tribunal is operating in the federal field, or vice versa? So if lawyers make arguments that a tribunal is outside of its proper jurisdiction, judges will hear it. They will hear cases with regard to abuse of power. Abuse of power means that a public official is acting outside his or her proper jurisdiction, outside the law. This is why it's so important as public officials to read the legislation and the regulations that govern you. Because if you move outside of that, you could be accused of abuse of power. And natural justice, if natural justice has been violated by an administrative tribunal or a public official, because public servants are expected to be impartial, then there could be an argument that there should be a judicial review of that administrative decision or administrative tribunal decision. Very often, provincial legislatures and the federal government have tried to put what they call a privative clause into legislation for administrative tribunals. And the privative clause says the decision of this particular tribunal is final. There shall be no appeal to any court. If someone goes to court and says, well, I've got an argument based on jurisdiction or abuse of power or natural justice, the judges will ignore the privative clause and hear the argument anyway. Something very important for you to know. We have just now run out of time. It's 5 o'clock. How many would like to come to the absinthe? No? Nobody.
Are you buying drinks?
Yes.
Oh, no, I'll be there. That was my only rope.
Yes, I think you need some kind of reward for surviving a 10 to 5, a very heavy day. Yes?
I actually have a question. I do want to address this in class because I thought actually that last comment was borderline rude almost. But I was reading Peter Russell's preamble. He says, he suggests that you guys can do what you want. He says Canadians should act more along Edmund Burke's line of thought, where he says Canadians should have some impact on the law, or the law should reflect society's changing. Mm-hmm. But then again, he goes on to say the Constitution should be extremely difficult to amend. Mm-hmm. It's along that, it's contradictory, right? When he says he believes Canadians should act more like Edmund Burke.
We'll discuss that more in the absent. But basically, I think what he was saying, the written Constitution should be very difficult to amend because it creates so much mischief. And he talked about the difficulties in the amendment process of 1982. But there are a lot of very flexible ways of changing the Constitution without a formal constitutional amendment. That was my interpretation of what he was saying.
Right.
So now the absinthe is in the basement of Winters College. You just go down the hallway this way, round to the right, and then down. And it opened 3 minutes ago. It's open until 2 a.m. I'm not going to be there until 2 a.m. But if any of you have the strength to go there, I would be delighted to buy you a drink. But I'll spend a few minutes here answering your questions. Oh, by the way, the list of who is commenting on which reading, I'll put this up on the class webpage, on my webpage, and then eventually on Moodle. But I'll try to do that over the next week or so in case you forget what you're doing.
Definitely.
It tells you this
one. I have to go look at it. Yeah, what is it like an essay?
That's what I'm going to clarify.
For what?
No, no. He said for my reading?
No, he said he's going to send us.
Well, I need to ask a question about the writing.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's what I have. I'm sorry, can I be? Thank you.
That's for the next class. No, there's three assignments. Two case studies.
Oh, yeah, this one.
Yeah. One case study, there's one in the January.
Probably help us. Why are you going to stick around here for a while?
Tell people you're going to
stick around.